05. This was held over from this morning's hearing. We have a proposed committee substitute on our desks here. I think people have had time to review the legislation, and I assume that there aren't any others who wish to speak on this. I see no one indicating otherwise. So I would accept Senator Kirby.
Okay. But what we had this morning was slash J, workshop, and this one says slash M. Is this just a new, this is the same thing, and we're not changing to
formal process? Okay.
But if, even though it's got a different slash and letter, it's the same thing. Okay.
That's what my understanding was. I was just looking for my staff, and I'm always assuring us that it's identical. Then I would take a motion this time to adopt the committee substitute.
So moved.
Mr. Hoffman moves that we adopt the committee substitute. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, that's ordered. Is there further discussion? Now, what, is there a letter of intent that's supposed to go with this?
Nothing necessarily.
Okay.
It's there. It's something that the department was interested in to say that they could work, continue to work on their solution if they didn't have it together at the work session.
Okay, well then that's fine. I'd be willing to accept the letter. Yeah,
so.
That's the whole premise here, isn't it? It's a two-year, duration.
Okay.
This,
so, present law then kicks in.
Yeah, I don't feel rushed on this.
I don't want to hold it up. I'm just trying to figure out for sure what happens.
Got the sunset?
After the 94
repeal,
then the 9th grade will be under the present statutory.
Yeah. Jeannie, why don't you join us at the desk? There seems to be some interest in sections 4 through 7. I don't know how far you had gotten this morning.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jeannie Fay, staff to Senator Cotton. And 4 through 7, what we were trying to accomplish is, in the original bill as proposed, the waiver provision was to last for 2 years, and it was going to be, I mean, it was described in some ways as a moratorium on direct action. And the Department of Environmental Conservation was not in support of that because they felt like it was taking the pressure off of the operators in the insurance industry to look for direct action provisions. Then when the work sessions, we went back and forth in terms of whether or not we should sunset it, whether or not we should make it open-ended. One of the versions kind of sunset it for the operators, but not for the department, and that didn't seem very workable. The idea of having this last, this section, Section 2 be repealed June 1st, 1994, was the idea. There was a lot of discussion that some of the problem is based on the direct action provisions provided under Open 90, and that a lot of the insurance companies have said they're trying to get states to repeal their direct action provisions, but they're also saying even if you do, we still won't provide coverage because under the federal law. So the idea of sunsetting this was that after this two-year period, there should essentially be kind of a fallout in the insurance industry, either when the Open 90 regulations are developed, the insurance providers will either sort of halt all shipping in the United States because none of them will provide any insurance because of the direct action provisions, and in which case something might be done on the federal level, or else the insurance providers will sort of be forced into providing this coverage. So basically, what this does, by repealing it in 1994, basically it'll force the legislature to look at it again, and if the circumstances are that direct action becomes available, there's no reason to be giving non-crude operators waivers. If it turns out that direct action is something that has been impossible for anybody to get in the marketplace, the legislature might want to consider not requiring that for certain types of operators. Is that?
So as of June 1st, 1994, the present statutes in terms of non-crude would take over.
Right.
Unless and until the legislature did something else. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Also, Brett Tostevin from the AG's office is online if we had any. Would you please work with us on this?
Did you have any comments, Brett?
No, I didn't have much to add. I accept that how JT explained it is that my correct understanding of what the intent was. It was to provide a window for the insurance markets to settle out, deal with the federal requirements, and to, in essence, keep people looking for direct action insurance during this period through the waiver provisions that this authorizes DEC to issue.
Are there other questions? Does anyone else want to make any comments on this? You ready for? Accept the motion at this time?
Separately,
or? Yeah, you can do that. That's right, in the Senate, they seem to move the letter first. That's fine with me. I'll stick with the provisions.
Okay, Mr. Booth.
Senator Pierce.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the letter of intent for Senate Bill 405, as unanimous consent.
Is there objection? Hearing none. The letter of intent will accompany the legislation. Senator Pierce.
Mr. Chairman, I would move CS for Senate Bill 405, oil and gas. 7-LS2003/M with individual recommendations and
consent. Hearing none, Senate Bill 405 with the letter of intent progresses. Okay, we're going to get our work on Senate Bill 270 at this point. We're going to try to focus in on a couple of sections and see if we can get, not resolution, we can get a list of questions that we need answered and attempt to come to an agreement on how Section 12 ought to read in this legislation. And again, Breck Tossis is online here. I talked to Breck earlier on today on the phone, so we've at least discussed some of these things already today, or at least I have, and still unclear on a couple of things, and I don't know if DEC is prepared to help us work through this. I didn't get a chance to talk to you informally today, but one of the things we're interested in is how the C-plans work right now. Maybe could you join us, Janice? Is Mike here?
He's not able to be here.
Oh. Okay, well, one of the questions that come up in regard to Section 12 is, there's several questions that come up. Originally, we intended to have it apply only to Prince William Sound, and I think the language that's in there right now is broader than that. And it was suggested to us by Mike Ford, who drafted the legislation, that we had to do it that way, otherwise we would be in violation of the Constitution, and that we were making a local or special act where a general act could have applied. And there may be a way to reword that to make it only be Prince William Sound, which was our intent, but uncertain as to whether this language does that for us. Does DEC have a position on that point?
The only thing I could comment on that, Mr. Chairman, is that because of the in-region capability requirement, I'm not sure that Alyeska really could move its resources outside of Prince William Sound without specific authorization from DEC. So I think that we certainly wouldn't have CERBs going down to off the coast of Washington and leaving Prince William Sound without response equipment.
Well, that's, I just wanted to point that out in case people are reading that and not sure as to what our intent was. And that's, again, I think that, I just wanted to make sure that people understood that the intent was only for Prince William Sound. Now, the other problem is, how much time are we talking about? And that's where I want to ask you about current sea plans. For instance, take any one of the companies you can think of. In their sea plan, they list Alyeska as the primary response contractor. And I guess there's how long is that person on contract to be their response action contractor?
How long is Alyeska?
Well, yeah. In Prince William Sound, I mean, Alyeska is everybody's rack right now, right? So how long does their responsibility last?
It's my understanding that as to the management of the response, it may switch after 72 hours. I believe that the contracts allow Alyeska to extend that time, but the way it's currently set up, the management changes in 72 hours.
The management changes to the spiller.
That's correct.
After 72 hours with the permission of whom? The federal or state on-scene coordinators have
it's
to approve that?
It's overseen by both the state and federal on-scene coordinators. However, I am uncertain whether or not their permission is necessary.
We understand that it is. Somebody from Alyeska, yes, they
that's
say.
I am not familiar with the details like those folks who work with it every day are.
Okay, yeah, well, that's what we thought Mike was going to be here, too. So that's too bad. So that becomes one of the questions involved here. Again, to other people have read Section 12 and suggested that means that, for instance, today we heard from Coast Guard and NOAA and DEC, and they inform us that Exxon is cleaning beaches is surveying and cleaning beaches in Prince William Sound from May 15th till June 15th this year. And so if we changed the law and had it read as it reads in Section 12, does that mean that had this law been in place that Alyeska would have been cleaning beaches this summer 3 years later? So that's the question that we need to get cleared up. And at this point, I don't know if you wanted to, did you have any comments at this point, Breck?
The only comment I would like to make is that the way Section 12 is written now is it puts a concurrent duty on Alyeska to respond, contain, and clean up a discharge. The same section 3604020 also provides a duty to the spiller or the person who permitted the spill. So it puts spill duty to clean up on a couple of different people. That doesn't necessarily mean that those parties can't allocate the responsibility between themselves or recover costs from one another under state law. I guess in the Exxon Valdez case, you had a fallen party to take over the remainder of the cleanup after Alyeska first responded. The question remains, what would happen in other spills if the shipping company wasn't a
fallen
entity.
I expect we'll walk through that scenario, but I think Senator Pierce had a question on that point.
Even though that responsibility exists, that dual responsibility, so that the shipper or the person who caused the spill is indeed responsible, on a practically speaking, how long would it be by the time you went through all the legal cases to get to a judgment where Exxon was told to pay Alyeska X dollars for the response that they did? This is a future case, not the present one, but I mean, obviously it's not going to happen. They're not just going to start writing checks because they'll end up caught up in the court cases too.
The remainder of that scenario, I mean, that's something else that we talked about earlier, Greg. What happens if Alyeska responds, the coordinators approve the handoff, and even though the management may switch, the Alyeska resources are still being used, assume that the spiller is insolvent, how does Alyeska get compensated for its efforts right now?
Well, under 822, it's not, which establishes the strict liability. It imposes liability not just on the spiller, but on the owner of the vessel, and also the owner of the oil. So Alyeska would have a cause of action or the rest, whatever the, I should say, whoever incurred the response cost would have a cause of action against the owner of the oil as well.
What about these federal, I mean, the federal funds? I mean, how do they become accessed? Isn't there a situation where if the, you know, there is a situation where the responsible party or parties don't have any money, Alyeska doesn't get stuck with the bill. It turns over. Janice perhaps wants to answer that question. There exists right now a scenario of relief for Alyeska, isn't that so?
Under both the state and federal law, we will reimburse Alyeska from the 470 fund, or could, if they respond to a mystery spill, an orphan spill in Prince William Sound and cleaned it up and took care of it. In a spill scenario where there was a federal on-scene coordinator and the federal on-scene coordinator directed Alyeska to clean up the spill, and the federal on-scene coordinator would be able to access the federal fund to reimburse Alyeska.
So if people are concerned that, you know, if Alyeska was by law required to respond, they'd be doing the same thing they're doing right now. If the people that were responsible for the spill didn't have any money, they would still have access to either the 470 fund or to the federal super fund to compensate them for their efforts. Isn't that true?
They certainly should. Whether that's clear as to the state reimbursement here is something that we have discussed in our offices, and there are mixed opinions about that. Whether or not it's clear in here, if they're performing their duty, does the state have the duty to reimburse them? That is a little, the federal operation is a little bit different than how the state operates. The state on-scene coordinator can actually direct Alyeska to do cleanups. They can direct any response action contractor.
Well, what about the feds?
That's what I'm speaking to. The Coast Guard can do that. Right. And it's very clear that they have the authority to reimburse those response action contractors. It is less clear for us, and there is not agreement within DEC that is clear, where Alyeska may be asked or may respond if someone else was supposed to and didn't.
Well, those are the issues that I had written down here. We also discussed the current lawsuit, which this really doesn't affect one way or the other, but should we prevail in court, I would hate to think that we would have lowered our standards by passing a bill that, you know, limits them to a certain amount of responsibility when the court may decide that they had a greater amount of responsibility. So it's that was a concern that I had. I don't know. Did you want to make any comment on that, Greg?
Not really. Beyond the fact that I think you're right. I mean, what we do in the future doesn't affect current litigation. Granted, it does. If you know, the state prevails in the future, but your concern is correct that, you know, you wouldn't want to necessarily weigh future victory. The important thing to remember is that this clarification section 12 isn't aimed
what I was trying to do was trying to lay out the, you know, the specific concerns that we had with Section 12 and try to give ourselves a way of figuring out how to address those concerns and perhaps rewriting Section 12. So, on the C plans for all the operators, do they list a secondary responder, or do they just list a primary responder?
The ones that I personally have seen have only listed a primary responder, but that is not, I have not seen every single contingency plan that's been filed with the department. But I'd be happy to see if anybody does. But I've seen about six or eight, and they only list a primary responder.
So the 567 regs don't require them to list a secondary responder?
We haven't received any contingency plans yet under those regulations.
Right, but do those regs require that, or, you know?
I just can't remember sitting here right now. I'd have to go back and look.
Do you have anybody else here that can help us out?
No, there's nobody else here from DEC today.
What are they doing?
I ran around with the Coast Guard guys.
I have a question about the APUC plan. Does any, or Breck or Janice, you, does anyone know what the procedure is that the APUC would use to review the charge imposed by the tariff imposed? Has anybody even looked at that part of it?
I haven't looked at that. I'm not a public utilities lawyer, so I have to defer that to them. I haven't looked at that question.
And any financial responsibility requirement, which means that they're going to approve some of the APUC approving amount of their bonding requirements. Well, it is read. A charge of financial responsibility requirement imposed by LESC on for the winter, for the purposes of the bank. So this is where we get to the Rick, on line 20, page 7, when we say subject to review by the APUC, is it inherent in that that means approval, or does that mean they just look at it?
Subject to.
I think subject to review simply means that it's within their jurisdiction.
Okay, then the next line says review may occur at the request of the tank vessel owner or as allowed by the APUC. So they can come in and say we want to review this at any time. The way that reads, correct? It says or as allowed by the APUC, and we say that it's subject to review by them, then any time they wanted to come in and review the tariff or any requirement, they could come in.
That's what it looks like on its surface. I can look, you know, to be sure, I would like to look into that a little bit more for you. But I'm not exactly familiar with the regulatory. I think it might be relatively easy to take a look and get back to you.
Well, it's clear that we're kind of bogging down here because obviously going to have to get back with DEC and get some information from them at a different point. So I don't know if anybody else wanted to make any new comments about this section that we haven't already heard before.
Yeah, I would like.
Anybody else?
I have a question.
Does anybody else want to talk today? A new subject, new material?
I have a different section, Mr. Chairman.
On section 12?
No.
Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Well, I had a question of the department. Under what type of scenario would containment activity, and I'm reading on line 29 of 7, containment activity result in greater environmental damage? I was wondering if there's an incident what type of incident would that apply to?
Good little exercise walking back.
First it goes stairs and then this. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, that is pre-existing law where it's been moved. If you see up in section 11, it's been removed from 020 and moved down here. I don't know why that switch was made, but there could be instances of that. Pardon me. Well, there's a hot water washing that occurred in Prince William Sound. There could be other things.
If you're specific to the containment portions, when we were looking at 567, we had a couple of scenarios that were brought up that can convince the legislature to put that in. One was the case, and remember that this applies to all spills. This is a Section H. It doesn't just apply to it doesn't just apply to G. So we were thinking about Prudhoe Bay area where you're dealing with with tundra. To tell them that they have to go in and immediately clean up a spill on tundra, they are part of their containment and cleanup activities are going to do more damage than if you go in a slow method and actually wash the tundra, which you can do. You treat it like a sponge and you wash out the oil. Put that in so that the DEC or whomever is able to direct a more methodical response than for you to pop in, because the whole language keys on immediately clean up and contain. And in some cases, you're not going to want it to be as immediate. The other thing in the Prince William Sound experience, and something that people talked about, they have some Valdez, in some cases, they inadvertently caused more damage in some of the bays because they deliberately used boom and drug oil into those bays to contain it. And while that worked great, they ended up causing more damage to those beaches than would probably have been caused. In retrospect, some of those decisions, they decided probably weren't the best decisions. They were done because people were trying to do something with some immediacy. And what we were trying to do was, within a specific law, give DEC some latitude, or to give the directors of a cleanup some latitude of how they were going to handle individual circumstances, because there'll always be something new or different. Always think of some exception. But you notice that it's only the department that can waive that requirement.
You think you got any questions?
Yeah.
No, I'm still reading the APDC stuff.
Ricky, did you want to testify on section 12?
Yeah.
Okay.
Short.
My name is Ricky Ott, and I'm with the Oil Reform Alliance. And we're concerned that, and I mentioned this briefly at the last conference, was that this first sentence of under G makes Alyeska responsible, or the common operating agent responsible, effective immediately. And we're concerned that this needs to be grandfathered in. So that
you mentioned it last time.
Right, so the amended wording change I have is line 12, just insert, as stated under the provisions of the State Trans-Alaska Pipeline System Right-of-Way Agreement, comma, and then you just go right in, the common operating agent for the holders and leases of the right-of-way agreement. That's it.
Okay.
And it just is a level.
We're going to probably ask our own attorneys and the
right.
Department of Law what their opinion on that type of approach is. So
But I didn't have the wording before, and that's just suggested wording.
Okay. Appreciate your suggestion on that.
It sort of jives with what the federal energy bill is trying to do. They say, as stated, in addition to the existing duties. That's the way they stated.
Right.
And their language just didn't work with this, so same intent.
Okay. Thank you very much. Larry, you got us here?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Larry Wood. I'm with Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. I'm pleased to be with you today. I had a few more comments concerning Section 12. Today I want to emphasize not so much the legal aspects, but the practical ones, and perhaps that is new. I would like to say, first of all, that when you look at Section 12, it is different from what exists today. You recall that Alyeska has a responsibility for the initial response pursuant to the contracts that we've signed with several different companies. This particular section, however, imposes responsibility for the entire response action, that is, to respond to and clean up oil. Now, one of the concerns that I would have immediately is when you make a switch like that, and as Mr. Tossefson already indicated, you're switching from a scheme now that provides for that type of responsibility on the spiller onto one particular response action contractor. One of the questions that I believe needs to be asked is how do you address the practical and economic consequences of what that does, because immediately Alyeska would have to reassess services it provides now and gear up, as we've heard mentioned this afternoon, to provide for a much more exhaustive response than what presently exists. The initial idea, of course, was for Alyeska to provide for only that initial response period and then to have the management of that be transferred to the primary responder. And in due course, the core equipment and core personnel for Alyeska would be shifted back to the terminal. One of my first questions would be, how do you relate the former scheme, that is with the spiller having that responsibility, and now shifting it to this initial response action contractor? Just how will that work? To whom will the Coast Guard look for this spill response?
If we could just maybe get conversational about it. That was one of the points that I started out with today. And trying to distinguish whether you need to be the person doing the work 3 years later, or were we interested in you being the initial responder? And it sounds like that you share that concern. And let me ask you a question, though. Like, if after 72 hours or perhaps longer, depending on whether the on-scene coordinators feel comfortable with the transition in management. And by the way, that is this. You nodded earlier when that question came up, but you can answer the question that transition does require approval by the on-scene coordinator.
That's correct. The transition process is going to be reviewed very carefully by the federal and state on-scene personnel, and they will have to be satisfied that the primary responder is in place and his management team is ready to take over. And we also, I talked about this earlier too, and that is about the core equipment and the core personnel that also will have to have the approval of the federal official in charge.
What will have to have the approval?
Eventually, the primary responder will bring in personnel and core equipment. Part of the problem here is that we would want to, it would seem to be, resume pipeline and terminal operations once that equipment can safely be returned to the terminal,
right,
as Ms. Adair explained. Otherwise, we've got a situation where we don't have some coverage in a very important spot.
Right, but the whole business, whole idea of this all taking place in 72 hours is kind of a misnomer as well, isn't that true?
I think it's added to a lot of confusion. I think in the beginning people thought that Alyeska would simply disappear, including its resources and personnel. It really is a transition of management.
So how do you describe that period of time? We've struggled with that. If we say Alyeska shall be the initial responder until the transition is approved, that, do you think that describes the situation well enough?
I testified before that I truly believe that because of the difficulty you get in describing every part of it, you're much better off dealing with the contracts that are concerned and also with the ongoing agency approvals. You're right, it begins to become very difficult because, number one, what is the initial period? Number two, when does it end? Number three, under what circumstances will that transition be approved? And number four, how do you write such a law that will be broad enough to provide for some discretion, but yet specific enough to provide direction. So,
well, that's what I'm suggesting is that you can say that the Alyeska will be the initial responder and shall remain on scene until the transition to the responsible party is approved by the appropriate authorities, apparently the federal or state on-scene coordinator. So then you don't pin it down to 72 hours or 4 days. You say that the responsible party is going to have to assume management and come up with their own equipment upon approval. And I assume that means that the federal coordinator or the state coordinator is going to say, okay, now it looks like you've got your stuff coming. So now, now's the time. So as soon as possible.
Well, that's the sort of thing, if you look to the C plans, the contingency plans, you'll see that type of language in there, but it's much more detailed than that. Mm-hmm. It raises another concern, which is, what if the spiller never assumes management? Now, Ms. Adair made reference to the federal and state funds, and I would like to also point out that currently, under the comprehensive scheme we have under the Oil Pollution Act and under state law, if the spiller does not show up, or if shows up, becomes insolvent, I think mention was made of that, there is a federalization that will occur, and the management then is transitioned to the Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. Coast Guard then would direct Alyeska resources to such time as those core personnel and core equipment can be returned to the terminal and the terminal restarted. So there again, I think we'd have to look at writing into that language something along those lines too, but by the time you get done, what we've essentially done is rewritten the C plan and the contracts, I suppose, into state law. It would become a very difficult exercise, and I don't believe will allow for the type of discretion that's called for. I've got another concern that I would like to raise.
Excuse me, Larry. Okay. Go ahead.
Under the Unified Command, first it's something like until permitted to leave by order of the Unified Command, or until federalization or whatever the proper legal terms for that has occurred. Does the Unified Command actually sign off? I mean, they say, okay, transition can begin to occur. I do know that they sit down at the table and they make this decision. Is there a paper trail? There are a hell of a lot of paper trails of those things, but is there something that the commanders actually sign off?
Senator Pierce, I'm not certain of that. I would assume so. I know that records are kept throughout the response that there's a record made of decisions. Whether he signs a document or a statement is made and it's recorded, I'm not certain, but we could certainly find out for you.
That might at least be a place where we could begin if we said...
defining a point in time.
Yeah, defining a point in time. Until permitted to leave by order of the Unified Command, by written order, by something, but the Unified Command makes that decision. And then the second tag might be, or the Coast Guard has federalized, or the state has made a way for taken over by the state, the spill, which they also, I think, have to do. I do know that certainly the Coast Guard, when they federalize, there's some sort of proclamation. There's something that happens. And so the key could be when that something happens, whatever the something is. I assume the state has the same. I know that the state is when the state declares an emergency. And that's real easy to tell, because there has to be a declaration of emergency. That's when we take over a spill. The feds have to have some same sort of kicker.
Yes.
And maybe we could use, at least it's a starting point to try to use those kickers.
But
beyond that time, then the spiller is responsible for the costs. They may tell you, you've got to stay. The Coast Guard federalizes the spill. At that time, you still have to, if they tell you to, you've got to stay, and you can't change that.
The Coast Guard can't, or the law says the president shall direct,
right,
which is the Coast Guard.
And you're there, like it or not. But the question about the liability in terms of cost, mm-hmm, then we make sure that transfers.
Well, the difficulty is, there's so many things I want to say at once, but who's the incident commander if this provision is enacted? The federal on-scene coordinator is going to direct the spiller to take charge of the incident command. In other words, that is a responsible party under federal law. Meantime, you've got a state law that, I guess, imposes the same duty upon Alyeska.
But the Unified Command has all those, and it has three.
Understand, but
table.
The incident commander, as I understand it, is going to be the responsible party. Under federal law, will be the spiller. Now, Alyeska shows up.
You're confusing me there, because you're suggesting that the federal government is telling you that the that the spiller has to be the initial responder?
That's right.
Well, no, that's not what the Coast Guard's told us and told you.
Okay, let me rephrase that.
Coast Guard has said
I'm talking
told
about
you
the,
that you
the,
have to be the initial responder.
I'm sorry. Okay, we're talking about the initial response itself. That's correct. I was focusing on what happens after the 72 hours.
Right.
But let's get back to that for a moment. It seems to me that there is a very high potential for a lot of confusion. The federal government is going to require that the provisions of Open 90 be followed by all concerned. And that will place the onus on the spiller, the responsibility for the response. Now, the confusion that I have is with the state law that imposes a concurrent liability, I guess, on Alyeska to provide some of the same sorts of functions. Maybe now we're talking about limiting when that period of time will be, but right now it's currently written the entire response. How will that work in practice if the U.S. Coast Guard has the primary responsibility under a congressional act to provide and to assure that there's an adequate response? And I guess it goes back to a concern I mentioned the other day, which is I think we're turning on its ear what had been and still is a very comprehensive and different scheme for oil spill response. We're creating an additional liability in state law, which, at least in my mind, conflicts with what Open 90 and HB 567 directed. So we haven't talked about some other problems, but I don't know if we're ready to move this from this one just yet. Are we? Okay.
Yeah, this was the primary reason, you know, we wanted to focus in on Section 12
and get all the
issues on the table and try to understand all the ramifications of what it meant and what the problems were. And I start out pointing out the same things you pointed out so that I'd preempt you so you know, I could say
I want to continue on Section 12, but I had some other thoughts.
Senator Pierce.
Under the present contracts that Alyeska has signed with the shipping, do you define initial response in some way, or do you say until Coast Guard allows you to leave, or until there's a turnover?
Okay.
What do you say?
It's defined. I have that contract in my briefcase, and I can either read it to you now or show it to you later, but I'm certain that all of that is described. It's also described in the contingency plan, which has been approved by ADEC, and it does talk about the transition of management. Talks about this issue of the core equipment and the core personnel and when they can return to the terminal. But it will get involved, and it does have to take into account a lot of exigencies, a lot of circumstances that we may not be able to readily anticipate. As long as we're on this section putting things on the table, I would like to add this to the concerns, and that is, where is prevention in all of this? I know one of the key components to dealing with oil spills is simply preventing them. In fact, that's probably the best way of dealing with them to begin with. But it would seem to me that by removing, at least for this initial period of time, and I guess that's what we're talking about now, this responsibility, or in some ways avoiding or at least ignoring the responsibility of the spiller, will tanker owner operators have the same degree of responsibility concern for oil spill responses they previously had? So I would like you perhaps to consider that issue as well. I talked about the confusion. I think that there's a real potential for that. And another problem I would like to lay out there is what happens between the spiller and Alyeska if there is confusion in the direction of the spill response. And I guess, again, before I came today, I thought we were talking about the entire response, but I guess we're
rid that confusion, and that's, you know, that's what we're going to attempt to do here when we define who will be there and who has the responsibility. And I think we're improving our understanding as we go along here. And again, I expect that when this bill finally leaves committee, there won't be any confusion.
Well, Senator, one of the other points I would like to raise has to do again with funding and the cost of this response. Now, as it's currently written, it's the entire response.
Now remember, don't base your whole premise on the entire response being?
Well, let's just take the 72 hours then, if that's what we're talking about.
The initial response.
I have some very legitimate, I think, concerns about what happens in case of a spiller's non-response or insolvency of his assets and also his insurance. To whom will Alyeska look for payment of its costs? Now,
if you could do me a favor here, we're about to run out of time, but I'm really interested in that.
Okay.
And I'd be interested in seeing it presented in two ways. Current law, current status, versus Section 12 requiring you to at least be there for the initial response. And that's really, I tried to ask that question the other day. How would a change like this affect your relationship with people who list you as the response action contractor on their C plans right now? What would change? So, and I apologize for interrupting you there, but I think I know what you're talking about. So you needn't do that right now, but that's what I would like to see, you know, current situation and proposed different situation.
I'd be happy to provide that. Are we out of time?
No, we've still got five more minutes.
A few more minutes? Okay. One of the things I'd like to leave this topic with is the need to focus in on the impact of these costs in terms of what it means to Alaska as an owner of oil. And I can either address that a little bit now or deal with it in that memorandum you'd like to see from the Senator. But
you can do it either way, Larry, and okay. We can do it informally too. You needn't, you know, prepare anything really elaborate here, but I think people are interested in a comparison of the scenarios.
One of the other concerns I would ask you to consider is what happens if the C plan holders, who under current law can either provide for this response themselves or contract with others, including Alyeska, as an initial responder, what happens if they come with a request to use another business entity, be it a cooperative, be it another business, be it someone else, and we've got written into the law a particular contractor that they have to use? What is the repercussion of creating a monopoly like that? What will happen in terms of the availability of other services that want to provide that? I mentioned in one of my earlier testimonies that Alyeska provides this in the absence of anyone else, but what if that should change and we have another capable organization that is willing to come in and take this over? The C plan holders make that presentation to ADEC. They can currently do it now and they get the approval, but meantime we have written into the law this overriding apparently a duty of only Alyeska providing for that.
Do you think that's very likely?
I don't have a crystal ball. I do know that it's been discussed on occasion in terms of different possibilities. How likely it is, Senator, I'm not the one to best address it, but I want to point out that we're painting ourselves into a corner in terms of what the other arrangements could be or what other tanker owner operators would like to do. There is no legal compulsion right now for them to use Alyeska. For them to use Alyeska for its initial response services. The tanker owner operators, the sea plan owners. There is no legal, let me rephrase that, there's a legal requirement that they present contingency plans and that the sea plans be approved, but they can either provide for the response individually on their own or they can contract with others to provide it. What I think we're attempting to write into the law is a provision that directs who they will use.
Well, you're...
And I'm asking, is that in the best interest?
The best qualified and the best equipped and the best trained and the most knowledgeable response action contractor, I've said this before, probably in the world. So I can't imagine somebody else matching your equipment and your resources and your experience and your training and so forth to offer us as qualified a contractor in Prince William Sound. That doesn't seem realistic to me, and maybe I'm being naive, but that's my initial reaction to that possibility, anyway.
Well, I appreciate the compliment, but I too don't know what the realistic opportunity for that happening would be, but I do want to point out that there would be a restriction, and again, I'm not certain of why we're doing it in light of the federal and state law provisions now, and why we would want to create concurrent liability, potentially conflicting liability, on two different entities. Mr. Tostevin earlier said, well, Alyeska could always turn to the spiller and collect its costs. And I would submit that's a very difficult process, and it would be long in coming, and those costs would have to either be reflected in an increase of our financial responsibility requirements and or the creation of some sort of a fund to provide for exigent circumstances, because we do not have direct access to the federal or state funds without federal or state involvement. And I guess I mentioned the other day I have a concern about how you would write that into state law, since it already exists under both the federal and state schemes for oil spill response. But I know I've talked over my limit, and I apologize for
that. No, that's all right. No, we really are trying to encourage it, you know, a full dialogue here. If I ever seem like I'm being short with you, I apologize too. So.
Thank you, Sam.
I just have a request. Since we're running short on time, could we have a copy of a representative contract with whose it is blocked out at your discretion, in terms of, so we have a better understanding of what Alyeska agrees to do as the initial responder? Or
I'd be happy to provide that.
So I think we might better understand some of your arguments. We could wade through one of those.
One of the remaining thoughts I have on that initial time period versus the entire response, it again goes back to what our primary goal in life is, and that is to transport oil in a pipeline safely and provide for the terminals. So I guess I would always be asking that we keep in mind also that the primary function would be, it seems to me, to provide for that initial response. And then when it's safe to do so, to get back and restart the terminal operation. So again, I guess I would leave on that note.
Yeah, I don't think we're too far apart there, at least the way I understand things. I think what a lot of people are thinking about. Mm-hmm. But include that initial response. And
well, thank you for this opportunity to talk about Section 12. I'd be very happy to get back with you on those other.
Right, and it's, I apologize, we didn't have enough time. There's another meeting at 5 o'clock right now. Ray, we didn't get to you today. And so if you have some written comments, we want to hear from people as to what their complaints are, or what their criticisms are, or what their suggested changes are. And we're going to continue to be very active on this. We know we only have about a month left of the legislature, and this is a piece of legislation that's extremely important, probably the most important piece of legislation left in this committee, and be sure that we're not treating it lightly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? We're adjourned.